That was the first of the three music segments of the Voyager recording that we're going to play you, the second segment of the recording itself, and the other two will begin previous to the next week's lecture and the lecture after that at 7:05 p.m. if you want to be here to hear the whole thing. People have been asking me all evening whether you can buy this anywhere, and the answer, unfortunately, so far is no, you can't. Columbia Records made the recording. They obtained the two recordings, the physical recordings are actually on the two spacecrafts. They obtained copyright permission from each of the 27 copyright holders of the 27 different musical pieces that are on the thing, only for a one-time release. And so if they were to put it out as a commercial recording, they'd have to do that all over again. And the problem is, as you will recognize, if you have ever driven across the United States, as I did to get to the Voyager launches and Viking before that, and try to listen to the radio to maintain your sanity on the way, the audience for something of this sort, although enthusiastic, would be limited. So far, Columbia, which has done some very courageous things in the past, I speak as a fan of 20th century classical music in quotes. In fact, that's how I got my start in radio. And they have done lots and lots of recordings that won't sell. I can't really blame them too hard to think about the stockholders on this one. But so far, the answer is no. There are rumors every once in a while that it is going to be put out as a commercial recording. So far, it hasn't.
Question?
How did you get it?
How did I get it?
That is a cassette which I obtained when I was there at Jet Propulsion Laboratory for the Voyager launches. Anybody who's a newsman can get that. And as a result of me personally, portions of it anyway, have been broadcast on radio stations in three different states. So I feel that I'm not taking advantage of my privileged position here. It's possible, in fact, we're working on it now at WULM in Ann Arbor, that we'll put together a one-hour special on the Voyager recording and the Voyager mission, which should be an interesting combination of the arts and sciences that, of course, this lends itself to. I'm going to talk about Voyager, and Sue Barber, who, among other things, is an ethnomusicologist, is going to do the explanations of the pieces, and it should be really neat if we can pull it off. So I don't know when that's going to be broadcasted, if indeed it's done. Some announcements real fast. I don't want to take up half the program with these announcements, and it's hurting in that direction. We will have several handouts in the back. The white mimeograph schedule, which we had each of the previous lectures as well, of astronomy, space events, my own lectures, and other things at the University of Michigan and elsewhere in southeastern Michigan. For those of you who are interested in my lecture series at East Lansing, that is the only part of that white sheet which is now incorrect because we got snowed out on a couple of them, and there is a yellow half sheet which updates that. So we got friends at East Lansing, even if you're not going yourself, that you might be taking a copy for, be sure you get the yellow half sheet, otherwise you aren't going to care about it. There are a few copies of some information about the L5 Society, which is the citizen space colonization organization that I talked about last week. And those are from a local L5 member. There are going to be more, he tells me, and so if by the time you try to get your copy, they've run out, don't worry, we'll have them next week. Likewise, the bookstore upstairs is going to have both the hardcover and paperback versions of Tom Heppenheimer's book, Colonies in Space. The hardcover is nice, it's a lot more expensive, but it is also a lot prettier. There are beautiful color illustrations which have just been done in rather miserable black and white in the paperback. They're going to have both, you can take your pick. They will also have the paperback only of Gerard O'Neill's The High Frontier, and that's the way to do it because the paperback is updated and revised compared to the hardcover. However, you notice they use the future tense. They've been ordered. They're going to be in as soon as possible. If we're lucky, we'll have them by the time this last lecture in the series is out. But if you would like a copy, there is a sign-up sheet upstairs at the book counter where you can simply sign your name and address, and that will be available after the lecture, and they'll let you know when it comes out. So you're guaranteed to get a copy that way if you'd like to do it that way. And finally, finally, the blue handout back there is a copy, a free copy for you of the February issue of the Sky Calendar, which is published by Abrams Planetarium at Michigan State, and is a very, very fine thing. I have been highly admiring of it for many years. The guy that does it is named Bob Victor, and the last time I was up there to give some lectures, he gave me a whole stack of them and said, why don't you give these out to your lecture audiences? And, of course, he's hoping that perhaps some of you will be interested enough to subscribe. I highly recommend doing it if you're at all interested in what is going on in the naked eye sky. And right now we've got a whole series of things up there. You have the most spectacular sky of the year in winter, for one thing, and you've got three bright planets for another. Mars making a close approach to the Earth right now. Jupiter, which is always spectacular, it's setting off UFO reports all over the map, I'm told. And Saturn, which is right next to the bright star Regulus. And there are a whole bunch of configurations that these are going through. And in the next few nights, the moon is going to pass successively by one of them after another. And of course, no matter how little you may know about the constellations, it's easy to find the moon. You can use the moon to recognize, most of us can do that. Jules Verne's From the Earth to the Moon, you know, the famous line, gentlemen, most of you have seen the moon or at least heard of her. The planet is sitting up there by the moon. Of course, the moon will drown out the planet, but you'll be able to recognize it, and then know where it is in the sky, and a week or so later, look in the same place at the same time of night, that's important, and there the planet will be. You know, so all that information you can derive from the sky calendar, it's a very good thing. It's only $2 a year. Tonight's lecture is the first of two to prepare you for the first of the incredible space events that are coming up in this incredible year, December 1978 through, well, actually 10 months through September 79. Pioneer Venus, the next U.S. planetary mission, the first one devoted to the atmosphere of another planet as opposed to a surface and interior. There is a little bit of geology we'll get out of this. About 87% of the mission is devoted to atmosphere. Pioneer Venus, I suspect, is going to be the most underreported space mission in history. The most underreported planetary mission in history, because the newsmen are going to get as far as the following and no further. Number one, they're going to discover that the Pioneer Venus spacecraft, there are two spacecrafts. They should be the same size. They're drawn at different scales here. These drones are both 9 feet in diameter. The orbiter goes into orbit around Venus. The multi-probe separates into five parts. The drum-shaped part, which is called the bus, and the three probes, three small probes and one large probe, and those enter the atmosphere of Venus and go through it down to the surface, but they are not intended to survive the landing. And they're going to get as far as seeing that. Then they're going to find that the Russians have landed on Venus, in fact, four times, and have sent back pictures from the surface twice. And they're going to remember that we have landed on Mars, and they're going to say, so who cares about Pioneer Venus? Well, the reason for that is that Pioneer Venus has the misfortune of being the first of a brand new class of planetary missions. So far, planetary missions have either been flybys like the Voyager, where you do your first reconnaissance of a brand new world that you don't know anything about, and so you don't know whether it'd be safe to land there or whatever. You fly past and get as much information as you can on the way past. Or they have the orbiters, such as Mariner 9 and the Viking orbiters, and of course the Pioneer Venus orbiter, which go into orbit around the planet and do observations from above as well as they can. And then there have been landers, and those have gone down to the surface and primarily studied the surface of the planet, taking pictures, that sort of thing, and the interior, such as the Viking landers on Mars, the Venera 7, 8, 9, and 10 landers that the Russians have sent to Venus. This is a fourth type. It is called an atmospheric probe, and the idea of it is to study the atmosphere rather than the surface. What I'm going to tell you about tonight, this lecture is primarily about the atmosphere of Venus. Next week is going to be primarily about the solid planet itself, the geologic aspects. And what I'm going to tell you about is why this is a very interesting atmosphere to be your first one, other than the Earth, to study in this kind of detail. There has been, of course, atmospheric study on earlier missions, but it's been more or less incidental. For example, on Viking, as the landers came in through the atmosphere of Mars, there were devices both on the landers themselves and on the protective aeroshells, which had the heat shields and so forth and protected them the early part of the entry. And those made as many observations of temperature and pressure and composition and so forth as they could. But the amount of instrumentation that could be afforded for that, afforded weight-wise more than money-wise, was limited. And so you got as much as you could. We learned some extremely important things about the atmosphere of Mars. If you attended my Viking Mars lectures last year, you'll remember them. And if you didn't, and now wish you had, if you're willing to truck out to Ann Arbor this coming Friday, you can hear an update on Viking atmospheric findings in the Astronomical Film Festival. And you can read about that in the white sheet also. The atmosphere of Mars was studied then sort of in passing. And that was called entry science. And we're proud of them out in Ann Arbor because some of the instruments were made there. Well, this is a mission in which the MONEY probe, anyway, is entirely entry science. And so what you are doing is studying the living daylights out of that atmosphere as you go down through it. And you must do this, of course, at the expense of having used up essentially all of your instrumentation for atmospheric studies, and so there's no point in trying to survive the landing. You're not interested in studying the surface anyway. We will be seeing more of this kind of mission in the future. The outer planets, Jupiter and Saturn, for example, the gas giants, are made entirely of gases and liquids. They don't even have solid surfaces. So you don't talk in terms of a lander on Jupiter. There's nothing to land on. You talk in terms of an atmospheric probe. The planet is basically one giant ball of atmosphere, which is so compressed through most of its volume by its own weight that you might as well call it a liquid instead of a gas. And the next planetary mission after Voyager, unless the politicians kill it, which they're still trying to do, they came very, very close this last year, and they're undoubtedly going to try it again, is something called Jupiter Orbiter Probe, which will be very much like Pioneer Venus. And in fact, Pioneer Venus, one of its aspects is that it is a forerunner. We'll learn some things from it about how best to do Jupiter Orbiter Probe. Again, there will be an orbiter, and there will be a single probe there. They'd like to have more. Jupiter has a much more complex atmosphere than Venus. Even on Venus's, you consider four probes necessary to begin to characterize it. You'd like to have more, but they simply don't have the money for more than one. But still, that will tell us a great deal about a very, very different kind of planet from our own, and that will be flown. That will be the first planetary mission launched from the space shuttle, and that will be flown sometime in the early 1980s. I think the launch date is 1981, and it gets there in 1983. I may be wrong in those numbers, but early 80s in any case. So what I want to do is tell you tonight about Venus, primarily its atmosphere, tell you why the atmosphere of a planet is interesting. So far, if you have attended other planetary lectures that I've given either here or elsewhere, you have primarily heard me rhapsodize about surfaces and interiors. And I am indeed an amateur geology freak among my other sins. That's probably the reason why I'm the only person who is enthusiastic about space colonization that I've ever met that doesn't want to go out and live in one. See, because the one thing you wouldn't have on a space colony is geology to study. You know, it'd be completely on a completely artificial world. I made it up one anyway, I don't know. But I want to give equal time now to the other aspect of a planet, the atmosphere, which is a very important thing about it. If you would like to win some bets next party you attend, I suggest asking the following questions to practically anybody, and I think you'd be able to win some bets from them. What is the nearest planet to the Earth, number one? Number two, what is the planet other than the Earth and Moon which has been the attention of which has received the attention of the greatest number of spacecraft? Number three, what was the first planet on which anybody landed successfully? And number four, what was the first planet from which pictures were sent back from the surface? And I am quite certain that numbers of the percentage varying from question to question between 80% and 95% would answer all four of those Mars. In fact, the answer to all four of them is Venus. Venus is the nearest planet to us. It can come within 25 million miles. Mars never gets closer than 10 million miles farther away than that, 35 million. The Russians have launched at least 18 spacecraft towards Venus, and the Americans have launched 5. Of those, 3 of ours succeeded, and depending on your definition, something of the order of 7 of the Russian ones succeeded. They had a whole string of early failures in their planetary program, which was more devoted to Venus than Mars, despite the fact that it is Mars that is the red planet. They had a string of early failures with a common mode. The spacecraft got into its parking orbit around the Earth and then either would not, the rocket wouldn't fire at all again, so it just stuck in parking orbit until it finally re-entered, or it fired insufficiently long and just went into a higher orbit around the Earth. And they kept at it and kept at it. The Russian space program is characterized by two differences from ours, in my opinion. Number one, their technology, although it is good, and you can't sneer at anybody who successfully landed on Venus, is not as good as ours. But number two, their will, or at least their politicians' will, is very much greater, and they have put up through absolutely unbelievable setbacks. For example, before they got the first successful landing on Venus, which was Venera 7, on December 3rd, 1970, 6 years before Viking Lander 1 touched down on Mars, before they got that successful landing, they had gotten four spacecraft to Venus and into its atmosphere, only to have them destroyed on the way down. And they put up with that, and they kept doing it, and finally they succeeded with Venera 7 to survive on the surface for 23 minutes. And when I tell you about what the surface conditions on Venus are like, you will realize that that, in many respects, is an accomplishment that is more difficult than what we've done on Mars, getting spacecraft to survive for several years there. Mars is an infinitely more hospitable environment than Venus. I mean, you know, Mars is homey, friendly, Earth-like. All the worst that ever happens is every winter a third of the planet's atmosphere freezes solid and falls on the ground. You know, I mean, that happens in Michigan these days. And on Venus, well, on Venus it's warmer at least, but it's a little bit too far in the opposite direction. The Russians followed that up with Venera 8, and then the last two in 1965, October of 65, almost a year before the first Viking landing on Mars, they got two very much larger spacecraft down on the surface, Venera 9 and Venera 10, and they sent back pictures from the surface, and those have survived for as long as an hour and 10 minutes in the surface conditions of Venus. I will show you those pictures next week, and each one took a single photograph, and I will show you those pictures and describe to you in great detail what they show, but this week is devoted to the atmosphere, and so I'm not going to talk any more about those now. Here are pictures of Venus taken from the Earth. When I show this in the planetarium, sometimes little kids' reactions is it's the moon because they're seeing the phases. But if you look at it, you will see that, in fact, it can't be the moon. You don't see any craters. You don't see any maria. You don't see anything. The entire planet is covered by a featureless white veil, which, in fact, is made of clouds. That is the reason that Venus is named Venus. Venus, you know, was not just the goddess of love. She was the goddess of beauty as well. And the planet Venus, this object that the Romans decided to name for the goddess of beauty, is a very, very lovely object when you can see it in the nighttime sky especially. It's the brightest thing in the sky, aside from the sun and the moon. It is so bright that you can see it in broad daylight if you know exactly where to look. And at night, it is so bright that under the right conditions, when it is visible after twilight has ended and there's no moon and you're away from all the city lights, Venus will cast a shadow on the ground that you can see. It is bright enough for that. So it's a very, very lovely object, shining so brilliantly and so dazzling whitely over there in the east before sunrise or in the west after sunset. And the Romans decided to name it for Venus, which really turned out to be kind of ironic because we found out the reason for that afterwards. We have known ever since there were telescopes that the reason that Venus is so bright, well, of course, part of it is that it is the closest planet to the Earth, but the other part of it is that it's totally covered by these dazzling white clouds. And it was only a few years ago that we found out, and we didn't find it out from spacecraft observations, by the way. This was from observations made from Earth, or at least from an airplane, so there are still things for ground-based astronomers to do. We found out what the clouds of Venus are made of. There had been, of course, all kinds of suggestions. There was the obvious possibility they're made of little droplets of liquid water like our own. And then we found out that they're actually quite cold. They're about 150 below zero Fahrenheit, and so the suggestion was made that they are like the highest clouds on the Earth, where the temperature is also cold enough to freeze water. Those are called the cirrus clouds, the little filmy things that you see sometimes. And those are made of ice crystals, which stick together and tend to form strings, and that's why you often get the mare's tail effect with cirrus clouds. And there are other suggestions. Perhaps Venus is a desert planet, and there are winds which raise veils of dust into the atmosphere, and the so-called cloud is actually dust instead. That's not at all ridiculous. It happens every once in a while on Mars. On Mars, it happens only once per Martian year, and that is the time when Mars is closest to the Sun in its yearly orbit. The extra heat seems to trigger instability in the Martian atmosphere that sets off these winds. But, you know, Venus is much closer to the Sun all of the time than Mars ever gets. So it was a reasonable idea, but it too, in fact, was dead wrong. Nobody guessed correctly what the clouds of Venus are made of, and I don't think anybody ever would have in a million years. They turn out to be made of little droplets of liquid, like the clouds of Earth, but that liquid is not water, it is concentrated sulfuric acid. Okay, that's just one thing about Venus. The surface temperature is 900 degrees Fahrenheit, day and night, summer and winter, and almost certainly equator and pole as well. And it does not vary more than 5 degrees during a Venus day, despite the fact that Venus rotates so slowly that it's the only planet in the solar system whose day is longer than its year. It takes 243 Earth days just to turn around once on its axis, and it goes completely around the Sun in only 225. So the motion of the Sun across the sky from Venus, if you could see it through the clouds, and in fact it appears that you can, as a hazy patch, the motion of the Sun is due more to the orbital motion of Venus around the Sun than it is to the rotation of the planet. Furthermore, the planet rotates in the wrong direction compared to all of the others except Uranus, and so the Sun rises in the west and sets in the east, and it sets 56 days after it had risen, 56 Earth days, and then you have 56 Earth days of night. And yet, during that entire 56-day night, the temperature does not fall by more than 5 degrees. It's less than that. We can measure it if we're more than 5 degrees. That's the limit of our measurement capability. This, too, was discovered from Earth by radioastronomical observations and then confirmed by the first spacecraft that was ever sent to Venus. In fact, history's first successful planetary spacecraft, which was Mariner 2. And which moved past Venus 15 years ago last year. Well, the reason for this high temperature is something else that would be pretty obvious to you if you were standing on the surface, assuming that you could ignore the temperature somehow. And you got to realize that temperature is hot enough to melt several metals, such as lead, tin, or solder, and it is twice as hot as a so-called hot oven in the middle of baking a cake. So I think you begin to see why I say it was a pretty incredible technological achievement for the Russians to be able to survive as long as an hour and 10 minutes under those conditions. But the next thing that you would notice is that the atmosphere is 100 times as dense as the atmosphere of the Earth. It is almost as thick as water. Water is only 8 times denser than that. In fact, there are actually some liquids which are less dense than the atmosphere of Venus at the surface. The pressure due to that enormous blanket of atmosphere is almost 1 ton per square inch, which is equal to the pressure half a mile below the surface of the oceans on Earth. And the atmosphere is made almost entirely of carbon dioxide, so that even if there were less of it, and even if it were cooler, you could not breathe it. So there you are, standing on the surface of Venus, with your spacecraft slowly melting around you, and the air trying to crush you like an eggshell, and all of a sudden it begins to rain sulfuric acid. This is the planet, the Romans named for the goddess of love and beauty. Actually, I'm being a little unfair there. It would not rain sulfuric acid. The temperature is so high, and the clouds are so high above the ground. See, that's how they managed to be 150 below zero, even though the ground is 900 above zero. The clouds are as high as 40 miles above the surface of Venus. They're a layer 9 miles thick, which extends from 30 miles up to 39 miles up. That was measured by the Russian Venera spacecraft on the way in through the atmosphere. More about that next week. They're entry science, in other words. And they are high enough up that sulfuric acid can be a liquid. In fact, it exists at all at those heights. But if it did try to rain, in the first place, it can't. The clouds are too thin. They never develop drops that are big enough that they would fall under their own weight. And, of course, that's what rain is. But they're really a thin haze, almost a smog more than clouds. But the thing is that if they did manage to produce droplets, the droplets would not only boil, but dissociate. They would break down into simpler chemical substances because of the heat 15 miles above the surface. And so what you would have to worry about is not the sulfuric acid rain, it would be the sulfuric, the decomposed sulfuric acid fumes. And that is what you would notice as you sat there on the surface of Venus watching the spectacle of your spacecraft melting. Okay, the most interesting thing about Venus is that it is so very much like the Earth. I guess I better explain that statement. Venus is the only planet in the solar system which is the same size, almost exactly, and the same weight, almost exactly, as the Earth. Therefore, you might expect that the two of them would be twins of one another. Obviously, they are not. At least they are not meteorologically. Whether they are geologically is a very interesting question, which I'll get to next week, but the answer is we don't know enough yet about the geology of Venus to be able to give you more than a hint. And so someday we must have a good Venus geology program. This particular one, Pioneer Venus, is devoted to the other aspect, the atmosphere. And I think you will begin to see why the atmosphere is interesting. If Venus, which ought to be a twin of the Earth, is so different from the Earth, then if you, at least atmospherically, then if you study its atmosphere, you will learn things, you will gain insights about the atmosphere of your own planet, which obviously we wish to understand. Ask anybody in Boston why we want to understand the Earth's atmosphere, and I think you'll get an intuitive feeling of appreciation for Pioneer Venus. Or for that matter, I think we were in Michigan a couple of weeks ago, and you will get insights about why your own planet is the way it is, and it looks very much as though it is Venus and not the Earth that is the normal one. And that if things had not been very, very special, if the Earth had not gone through a whole series of rather unlikely coincidences in its early history, including the development of life on this planet, we would have been like Venus. I'll explain what more of what I mean by that a little bit later on. But this is the significance of understanding Venus. As far as its atmosphere goes, and that's what Pioneer Venus is about, that and one other thing. Venus has the simplest weather in the entire solar system because there are so many things that are even across the planet. The rotation of the planet is very, very slow, so it doesn't disturb the weather systems. We have always known that oceans on the Earth have some big effect on our weather. We've never known what that effect is. In science, what you like to do when you run into something like that, where you've got a result that you think is being determined by a particular variable, among others, you do a control experiment where you remove the variable and see what happens. Unfortunately, you can't do that in this particular case. You're not allowed to remove the oceans of the Earth and see what it does to the weather. Something about saving the whales, they won't let you do it. So what you do instead is you go to another planet which is like the Earth in many respects, certainly in size, and yet where the atmosphere is so hot that you are guaranteed there is no ocean-land variation across the surface because there couldn't possibly be liquid water at that temperature, even at that pressure. There's no way water could be liquid. On top of all that, Venus has no variation in temperature from point to point across its surface. And it has a greenhouse effect, which is due primarily to the major constituent of its atmosphere. Greenhouse effect is the name for the effect, which is why Venus's atmosphere is the reason that it is so hot there, and so hot there all the time, and it doesn't cool off at night. Greenhouse effect is named because of a prevalent scientific myth, which in fact is incorrect, that the glass of a greenhouse makes the air inside hot, for the same reason that an atmosphere of a planet makes the planet hot. It doesn't, but that's how the thing got its name, and you can get into all kinds of arguments with scientists about that. There are myths among scientists, just as with everybody else. The